Eric Arno, member of China Writers Group, also has a wonderful website called Bumble Buddha. Is it Bumble Buddha or Bumble Buddhist? Yeah, Bumble Buddhist. About his life as a monk and travels in China and temples and et cetera. It's fascinating. He also does a lot of political articles, and so he is in Moscow, Russia. An American who lives in Chiang Mai, Thailand. We're good friends. My wife and I lived in Chiang Mai for a year, and we got to know each other quite well. So this is the second installment of his travelogue in Moscow, Russia. So tell us what's going on, sir. Take it away.
Okay. Well, yesterday I decided to take a tour of the Victory Museum. The Victory Museum is evidently the largest museum in Europe dedicated to World War II. It's comprised primarily of exhibits related to some of the major events of World War II. For example, there were the Battle of Stalingrad, for example, which is. Just to give people who are listening may not know much of the details of what World War II is actually about. So I'll run through some of the things that are talked about in the museum. First of all, people may not understand this, but on June 22nd, 1941, the combined armies of not just Germany, but Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary, I think in total, 8 different countries, all part of the NATO, the German Nazi hordes, all allies of Nazi Germany. And my error in speaking as NATO was deliberate. They invaded the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union knew that it was happening. In 1930, Joseph Stalin, who had become the leader of the Soviet Union following the death of Lenin, basically said, we've got 10 years to industrialize the country to the point where we can take on a major attack, because we know that they want to destroy us. And they took the West 200 years of industrial revolution in order to get to where they were, or the way they were in 1930, 1940. And we've got to do the same thing in 10 years. And under Lenin, they actually did electrify the country. They educated the population to from basically 80% illiteracy to producing scientists, artists, musicians, engineers, the kind of a society that could actually take on the most dangerous military of the time, which was the Nazi army, which had overrun all of Europe. Now, one issue that people may not realize is that when the Nazis invaded Denmark, Holland, France, and so on, they did not meet major resistance from those countries. They basically said, okay, well, we'll give it a try, but if we can't put up with it, it's not worth destroying our cities over. So Paris, it took the Nazis, I think it was like, maybe you know this, Jeff, 26 days or something to capture France. And
I don't know. You probably have studied that particular point more than I have. I'm much more informed about D-Day.
Sure.
And towards the end, but the French were just, a lot of people don't realize that in World War I, the French lost 5% of their entire population. In fact, from 1914, the population did not go back to the original 1914 population until 1960.
Wow.
It was that severe. So they just did not have the will to try to do what they did in World War One against the Nazis. And as it turned out, it was the right thing to do, because otherwise the country would have been destroyed, and the French population would have been decimated for nothing, because at that point the Germans were going to win, were going to be able to take over anyway. And they only took over about a little, maybe about half the country. There's half the country was still free, still liberated. Mm. So but yeah, it fell pretty quickly, just because they just did not have the willpower to do a World War One redux.
I think there was the main difference between Western Europe and the Soviet Union, and specifically the Slavic Soviet Union, is that the Nazis did not have the same attitude towards Western Europe that they did towards the Slavs. You know, they were very clearly, their plan for Russia was to destroy it as a physical entity, enslave the people and kill the rest. That was actually the plan. I mean, they were quite explicit about it. And that's the reason why the Soviet Union fought so fiercely, because they knew that it was a matter of life or death to them. In any case, as I said, it took 26 days or something, somewhere in that area, to defeat France. But when the Nazis invaded the area, what is called the Belarusian Soviet Republic, which was what we now call Belarus, there was a major fortress there called the Brest Fortress. And the Brest Fortress, they actually have a replica of the Brest Fortress in the museum. And it took they thought they were going to overrun the Brest Fortress in a day, and it took them a month, because the people, they were just so fierce, they simply would not, these are the Soviet soldiers, they would not give up. So that was the Brest Fortress. Then you had the Battle of Moscow, where the Nazis were sure that they were going to take Moscow. They got to about, I think, around 10 miles from the center of Moscow. They could see the Kremlin with binoculars. But by the middle of, it took them so long, and they were so weakened by the fierce Soviet resistance, that by the time they got to Moscow, they were not able to take it over. They were not able to push forward. And then the Russians did a counterattack using fresh troops that they had brought from the Far East, and so they pushed the Germans back about 100 miles or so. Well, they tried again in Stalingrad. And in Stalingrad, that battle started roughly a year later. Stalingrad involved basically 2 million soldiers on both sides died in Stalingrad. And just to give people an idea, the United States lost 400,000 soldiers in all of World War II. The continental United States was not touched. There was a pinprick attack, basically, at Pearl Harbor, but nothing else was really hit. Stalingrad was leveled, and as I say, 2 million soldiers on both sides died. Finally, of course, the Soviet Union defeated it. And what is significant, I'll get to this when I go back to Volgograd. But what was significant is the fact that both the United States and England praised the Soviet Union for defeating the Nazis in that city. There was another exhibit, which is Leningrad. And Leningrad, which is now called called St. Petersburg, is very close to the Finnish border. And the Nazis wanted to take over Leningrad, and their plan, because it's named Leningrad, named it after the founder of the Soviet Union, their goal was to wipe that city off the map. And I attached a brief video, Jeff, of the exhibit, where it shows a panoramic painting of what the what the battle is about, including sound, you know, the sounds of what a battle sounds like, you know, with guns and cannons and all these kinds of things going off. And above the panorama is a quote from the German saying, in our view, there's no reason for this city to even exist with this war. We're basically, they're saying we're going to wipe it out and destroy it, and along with all its people. Well, something like 900,000 people died in the battle. These are civilians and military died in that battle, including Vladimir Putin's younger brother. His baby brother died during that time. So this victory, the reason why I'm talking about this is that the Victory Museum is a reminder to people of what war, to what a total war is really about. And people in the West really have no idea of what war is. They've never experienced it. All they get is very sanitized versions of what they're told in the media. And as a result, and they also have no empathy. They can't put themselves in the shoes of a Vietnamese or an Afghani or an Iraqi, and certainly not of a Russian, because as far as they're concerned, these are, you know, it's just kind of almost cartoonish ideas of what actually these people go through. So that was basically what I saw at the Victory Museum. I don't know if I mentioned this, but on Sunday, I got to Victory Square or Victory Park, and there were some young kids there signing up for. I did talk about that, but I'll just mention it again. They were young kids having little demonstrations or little games you could play, so to speak, in order to qualify for certain things. So this is the, I'll show you this. This is I won two medals here for my participation in this, and gave me the right to send a letter to the people fighting in Donbass, which I thought was pretty cool. One of the exhibitions was to watch and help put together, you know, this AK-74 rifle. I said, I'm just not into that, so I didn't do that. But in any case. It looks to me, from what I can see, that Russian society is being they're beginning to understand more and more what's actually going on, what the stakes are. But you still have a significant portion of the Russian population which grew up during the 1990s, was educated in the 1990s, that still don't really understand, you know, what's at stake. I want to talk about a short video that I saw this morning on the Jackson Hinkle show, where he had Doug McGregor, Colonel Douglas McGregor on. Mm-hmm. And Colonel Douglas McGregor is one of the good guys who actually says that, you know, Russia's got a point, that NATO shouldn't have expanded and so on. And then he goes on to say, if it weren't for the nasty Soviet Union and the socialist system that enslaved everybody, everything would have been just fine. And their idea was to create something called a Soviet man. What is a Soviet man? It's somebody who's a brainwashed automaton, essentially. That's what he's saying. So, to speak of so when he talks about a Soviet man, I, in honor of his statement, I am wearing my official Communist Party of the Soviet Union.
Oh, can you stand up? Can you stand up, please? We can't see it.
I'm going to stand up. So here's my.
All right.
And well, that's cool. You can see these are the four
the cosmonauts.
Cosmonauts, right? And it says Slava, so that's honor or glory to the cosmonauts of the Soviet Union. Somebody gave this to me a few years ago, and I hardly wear it. It's sort of a more of a memento than a something to wear, you know. But anyway, he was saying that there's really, you know, this is a like a slave-like person that they're, you know, they're brainwashed and everything. And I'm thinking, so you're saying that the first guy in space, Yuri Gagarin, it was not a Soviet. He was a Soviet man, but he was a nothing. You know, he was like a mindless automaton. Right. And the woman who took me to the first exhibition, Irina Boyko, you know, she is a Soviet era person. And you and I both know her. This is a woman of exceptional character and intelligence. And I'm thinking, if this is the worst that he can talk about as far as a Soviet person, you know, I look at that. There's this movie, The Century of the Self, which talks about the inculcation of selfishness as a value in Western society. And he's complaining about people who actually believe in working collectively together to build a society so that it becomes great for everybody. This is a bad thing. You know, this shows the level of ignorance and arrogance that is so endemic in Western thinking that it seems like it's practically incurable. You know, so that's the statement I want to make. And if you have any comments, we can discuss it.
Was it McGregor that said that?
Yeah, Douglas McGregor. Yeah,
it is.
You know,
He just has an anti-communist, anti-socialist corn cob up his butt, and he won't pull it out. So what are you going to do? You know, it's just so typical. Because otherwise, right, his analysis of Ukraine and NATO and you know, the dynamics of what's going on in that war are really outstanding. But yeah, that is all too predictable, I'm afraid. It's just sad to say. I would like to point out to the people that Eric has brought up something very important, and I would like to put some numbers to it. The total number of allies, including civilians, and this includes the Pacific Ocean, the Pacific Theater, and the European Theater, and the bombing of London, you know, with the V bombs by the Nazis, and everything else. The total number of civilians and military who died among the Allies was 966,000 people, not even 1 million people. There is absolute bulletproof evidence that 25 million Soviets, Russians died, civilian and military. And let's not forget also that in China, why was the United States able to beat only 18% of Japan's army? Because the rest of the army was in China trying to stand up against the communists. And so it was Mao Zedong and the communists who fought the fascist Japanese and the fascist KMT, Chiang Kai-shek. And at the end, after the Japanese surrendered in 45, it was the United States was also had 100,000 troops, 20 divisions in China fighting against Mao. And it was because of Mao Zedong and the Communist Party and the People's Liberation Army that they were able to defeat the Japanese, the fascist Japanese, which was an ally of Germany. And how many people died in China during the Civil War? At least 25 million people. And I've done some calculations. where it's as high as 35 million. But even if we only take the 25 million for China and the 25 million for Russia, that's 50 million people who sacrificed their lives to defeat fascism. And the Allies lost not even 1 million. So they lost less than, the Allies lost less than 1%. Is that what you see? Yeah, 1 million out of 50, no, 2%. 2%. They lost less than 2% of the people that the Soviets and the Chinese lost in order to defeat global fascism. So maybe you can understand and appreciate why the victory over Japan is so important for the Chinese, and why the victory over Germany and the Nazis in Europe is so important to the Soviets, because they paid the ultimate sacrifice. They paid with tens of millions of lives. And that is an historical fact.
Now, so Jeff, there's
point out.
Yeah, one detail which is significant. Getting back to the Japanese war, is that the Japanese were in Manchuria, Manchuoko, I guess it was called, and this is a major threat to the Soviet Union, because they were afraid that the Japanese would attack them. Fortunately, there was a Russian spy in Japan at the time, who was a close friend of the German ambassador. In fact, he was actually making it with the German ambassador's wife. Kid you not. There are shows that, you know, Russian shows, TV shows that talk about this stuff. Anyway, so this guy, he predicted the invasion of the Nazis, and Stalin unfortunately was getting so much conflicting information that he wasn't sure that were they going to attack on this date or another date? And he was not sure. And that was one of the main reasons why Stalin did not try to preempt attack, and which I'm going to address in a second. But one of the other issues was that he also correctly informed the Stavka, that is the Soviet's high command. It's like the equivalent of the chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, mm-hmm. that the Japanese had been defeated in a short war, I think in 1940, by the Soviets, and they thought, well, I don't think we should fight them. And so as a result, when the high command in Moscow heard that they were safe in the Far East, they brought 1 million soldiers across country to do a counterattack on Moscow, and that was like the death blow to the attack by the Nazis on Moscow. And at that point, many of the German officers, the high German officers, realized the war is lost. They thought they were if they could take out the Soviet Union the way they took out France and Western Europe, that the war would be over soon, and that they'd be fine. But they were not up for a battle of attrition, which is what the World War II turned into. There was another major aspect of this, Jeff, which is that at the Potsdam Conference, it was either at the Yalta Conference or the Potsdam Conference. The Yalta Conference was early in 1945. It was shortly before Roosevelt died. Stalin agreed that 3 months after the war was over, so the war was over in Europe on May 9th, that the Soviet Union would stage an attack on the Japanese army in Kwantung, that is in Manchuria. And The Soviet military, by that point, after 4 years of in total war, total industrialization, and of course a massively experienced Soviet war machine, basically wiped out 1 million man Japanese army in northern China. And the reason why, this is somewhat speculative, one could say, but the reason why the Japanese capitulated was because, like the Germans, they're fascists, and they'd rather surrender to the fascist American capitalists than to surrender to the socialist Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I hadn't heard that number. I wrote about this in the China trilogy, that the atom bombs that Truman dropped did not stop the World War II in the Pacific. That's not what caused the Japanese to surrender, because the United States had already incinerated, I think it was 62 cities in Japan with M69 napalm phosphorus bombs that were created by Harvard University. War crime bombs, and there was nothing left of Japan, and they all had, you know, mulberry windows and bamboo walls and et cetera. And so when they dropped those napalm phosphorus bombs all over Japan, they just burned like tinder, like pine tinder. And so when the emperor saw Hiroshima, the photographs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they looked just like Tokyo and every place else. They looked just like all the other 62 cities that had already been bombed. So city number 63 and city number 64 did not persuade the emperor to surrender. But what did get the emperor to surrender is he was a rabid anti-communist, and he was a racist against Slavic people. And Russia, the Soviets went into, as you said, Manchukuo, which is today is Manchuria, Japanese Manchuria. And Japan's best army, I think it's in my book, it's either the First Army or the Eighth Army.
It's called the Kwantung Army. Yeah, that's what I was referring to.
It's either the First One or the Japanese First Army or the Eighth Army. And in 10 days, the Soviets wiped out 80,000 of the best Japanese soldiers of the Imperial Japanese Army. That's why the emperor surrendered, because he knew that at that point they were marching to Port Arthur, which is today Dalian, in northern China, which is a major deep water port in northern China. And they were going to come in boats to Japan. And the last thing the emperor wanted was a bunch of Slavic communists invading his country. So that's why he capitulated. It was not because of the atom bombs. In fact, the results of Nagasaki and Hiroshima looked no different than the 62 other cities that the Americans burned to the ground and killed. The numbers have been completely censored, but likely, you know, millions of people, hundreds of thousands, were left homeless, injured. Basically the country was totally destroyed by the Americans bombing a civilian 62 civilian cities. Now the million I'm not sure about, but I have read, but still, if you can wipe out 80,000 of Japan's best soldiers in 10 days, that sent shivers. I mean, that's what, 15, 16, 17 divisions, Japanese divisions in 10 days. That just shows you how ferocious the Soviets were. You know, communists hate fascists, and fascists hate communists. But the communists had an ideal, you know, to survive and build Russia into a global power. the Japanese were just hanging on to land that wasn't even theirs. They were in Japan, you know, a long way away from the Japanese archipelago. So anyway, that's, you corroborated what I've written about, and do they talk about that in the Victory Museum?
Actually, I didn't see that aspect of it, interestingly enough.
Okay.
So they were mainly talking about the war, and they were basically, it was mostly about the war in Europe. And I'll also add to that in addition to the major exhibitions about Leningrad, Stalingrad, the Battle of Kursk, which we should talk about the Battle of Kursk, which was a major battle that it was like the last major battle that the Germans attempted as an offensive against the Soviets. And recently, Andrei Majdanov referred to this battle as a comparison to the ongoing counteroffensive in Ukraine by the Nazi government of Kiev. And he was saying that it was basically the same strategy that the Russians had very deep defensive lines built in. They made it very difficult for the Nazis to advance. And when the Nazis expended as much of their momentum as they could, there was a big counterattack. And
is it, of course, the one that was still analyzed today in military colleges? And it was with tanks, wasn't it? Isn't that the one that was with tanks?
That's right.
Yeah.
Right. It was like
very famous. It was a tank war.
Right. And, you know, when we hear stories about, oh, England is going to send 41 tanks to Ukraine and Germany's sending 40 tanks to Ukraine, the Nazis had, you know, like 2,000, 1,500 tanks, some, you know, well over 1,000 tanks. And the Russians and Soviets likewise had. So what we're seeing in Ukraine is actually a small version of what happened in Kursk, but
yeah, 2,000 tanks,
right? 2,000 tanks. But the one of the other aspects that is important to bring out is that we're talking in this latest war in Ukraine. What forces are at play against each other, and as Andrei Majdanov points out, the Russian general staff, that is the military culture of Russia, their original institution that trained officers is older than the United States. So the United States thinks it's going to win a war against Russia when they don't. They have no conception of what war is. In fact, one of the few truth-telling generals, General Kavoli, said he's never seen anything like what's going on in Ukraine. You know, our military has been trained to fight barefoot or sandal-wearing, AK-47-bearing Afghanis or a third-rate military of the Iraqis that had been already virtually wiped out. They had no air defenses at all.
Or so, Grenada or Panama or, you know, all right. These pissant countries that didn't stand a chance. Libya, you know, it's just unbelievable.
Right.
Yemen, the proxy war in Yemen.
So, and now the museum does have a decent sized, it's like a hall with a number of aspects of what NATO is. And I want to also bring out an historical fact that when the Soviet Union clearly had won, and during World War II, Churchill and Roosevelt had both praise the Soviet Union for its efforts in defeating the Nazis. They knew who defeated the Nazis. So to all of our esteemed listeners, anybody who tells you that the United States defeated the Nazis and the Soviet Union played a kind of a bit part. Just to put that idea out of your mind, because it is exactly the opposite. Shortly after the victory, Churchill sent a memo to his generals and said, okay, let's do this. Let's mobilize 100,000 former Wehrmacht, that is German troops that had fought in the war against the Soviet Union. Let's re-equip them and put ourselves together, and we're going to reinvade the Soviet Union. Patton himself said he was going to make it to Stalingrad if the German general was not able to, Patton, General Patton, the famous
George Patton.
He was going to get to Stalingrad. Well, of course, the Russians found out about all this, and they confronted Churchill and said, you know, what the hell's going on here? Your troops are positioned in a really funny way here, and you know. And Churchill says, "Well, I'll get back to you on that. I guess I'll check with some of my people to see what's going on." And of course, it didn't happen. But what is significant is that NATO came about after World War II. Churchill gave his famous Iron Curtain speech in 1946. Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, a specter has come down around Europe and blah, 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 how terrible the Soviets are. These are the people who saved his ass. You know, Churchill, England would have been crushed by the Nazis. And this is the thanks that that Churchill and the British gave to the Soviet Union. It's just a disgrace. And NATO, people say NATO was a defensive alliance. NATO started after World War II, and Russia, the Soviet Union, only responded with the Warsaw Pact like a few years later. So people need to get it out of their head that NATO is a defensive military organization. It is not. And it's proven by its recent actions, which are shown in the museum: Libya, Syria, Yugoslavia, Yemen, Somalia, and so on. Mm. And now they want to expand to Japan and to the Pacific. This is an expansionist, aggressive organization. So, and fortunately, the museum does point this kind of stuff out.
That's cool. You mentioned Andre. You quoted Andre Hu a couple of times. Who is that person?
Yeah. No. Speaking of the Soviet man, okay, Andrei Matryanov is a Russian-American guy. He came to the United States shortly after the fall of the Soviet Union. He had been trained as a military officer in the Soviet military, I think in the Navy. And after the Soviet Union fell, he came to the United States, and he's been living here ever since. I guess he got a good job, and but in recent years, he basically has been talking about the difference between the Russian military culture, Western military culture, and so on. And his work is very, very important, because he's pointing out the kind of meta aspects of the differences between the West and the Russian military. And basically, what he says is that the Russian military has much, much deeper cultural roots, and the Western military got its lessons on World War II fighting strategy from the Germans, who lost.
So
it's the West's own arrogance and belief in their own superiority to the Russians, which is basically a fatal flaw. The second fatal flaw, which he points out, is that when Russians make weapons, they make weapons to fight and win wars. When the United States makes weapons, they use them to make a profit.
Yeah, it's all about money, putting money into Wall Street and the military contractors. It has nothing to do with protecting the United States. That's secondary.
Right. So this is something that So anybody who had followed this from the very beginning, like I did, and I think you to a certain extent also did, you know, starting in 2013, 2014, 2015, and on for 8 years before Putin, unprovoked, you know, for no reason at all, invaded poor little hapless Ukraine, which was actually a regime fueled by Nazi ideology that was put in power by Victoria Nuland and Joe Biden himself. Anybody who thinks that Russia had no reason to invade Ukraine, they simply don't understand the situation. What had been happening, again, for people who don't understand, and many people on the left don't, they do not understand this. Imagine you're the United States, and and Russia and China have decided to overthrow the governments of Mexico, Canada, Cuba, all of Central America, and much of South America. And they're putting military bases there, and they're putting biological warfare facilities in these countries. What would the United States' reaction be in that situation? Would they just put up with it, or would they attack? What do you think? What happened in the Cuban Missile Crisis? The Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy says to Khrushchev, if you don't get your missiles out of there, we're going to attack. And fortunately, they were able to negotiate their way out of a potential nuclear war. Well, after the Soviet Union fell, and James Baker and many other quote-unquote diplomats, which are translated correctly, professional liars, convinced the Soviet Union that it didn't have to worry and that the Soviet Union could dissolve and we'd all sing kumbaya together. NATO had promised that it wouldn't expand 1 inch to the east of Germany. And since then, it has expanded to surrounding all of Russia. And they wanted Ukraine.
And now Finland.
Which Finland was also, Finland was an ally of the Nazis during World War II. Yeah,
absolutely.
Sweden was a secret ally of the Nazis during World War II. They were providing them with crucial minerals. So this war that is going on right now, this is not the Ukraine, the little poor Ukraine against Russia war. This is the war of Europe, colonial, imperialist Europe, which has been terrorizing the world for the last 500 years, and the rest of the world has finally gotten strong enough. And now with countries like Russia and China, you know, leading the way, saying, you know, you guys are not going to do this anymore.
Iran and North Korea. And yeah, I mean, those four, I call them the Asian Quad. As long as they stick together, there's nothing the United States and NATO and Europe can do to budge them. So, and they're together arm in arm. they're not moving.
Right. Well, it's true. That's certainly true. But I mean, Russia's, you know, clearly, you know, on the front line of this.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely. They're the ones losing lives again, you know, to fight fascism, which is simply an evolution of capitalism. And that's all fascism is. It's just a more advanced state of capitalism.
Right.
And
Lenin's book was Imperialism is the Final Stage of Capitalism.
Imperialism and fascism are
hand in hand.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Eric, this has been a wonderful discussion, and I can't wait to do number three and number four and number five. Again, this is Eric Arnaud, and he is in Moscow, Russia. I already gave a nice introduction earlier. I will put all of the his website, and he sent me a bunch of pictures I've got to put with the first installment, but I'm waiting for my editor in Pakistan to do the transcript. I now have a policy of never publishing anything that's in audio and video that has not been transcribed and edited, you know, for readers also. So I'm waiting. He should have it by tomorrow. They'll be behind a couple of 3 days, but we're going to get them all out. And I can't wait to hear about what you're going to do tomorrow. And whenever you're ready, we'll do another show. This has been terrific.
Okay, Jeff, right, I just want to. I'm assuming that I can take all this and put it on my website as well.
Oh, of course, absolutely. Give me a few days. I'll send this to my editor in Pakistan as soon as I hang up. Well, first off, I transcribe it with using AI, online AI, from audio or video to a Word file, and then he cleans it up he cleans up all the garbage, and then I have to go through and do a final edit, you know, to make sure it looks nice and reads nicely. So anyway, I will see you on the next time in Moscow. Eric Arno, American geopolitical analyst, tourist, and good friend and comrade. Bye-bye, Eric.
See you.